and a warm welcome to the Reform Party podcast. It's occurred to me that as I've spoken to various councils over the last few weeks, they seem to be hamstrung in not being able to do the things that they want to do. And it's become clear that the main problem is primary legislation, which has got its tentacles right into everything that, in local government. And it occurred to me that one of the first things that we need to do if Reform were elected on a national basis is to repeal a lot of this legislation. So I wanted to go through the various things I think we need to get rid of. And joining me to discuss this, I've got Mr. Mark Fleming. Welcome, Mark.
Hi, Ken.
Right. So as I say, when I've been speaking to people, a lot of the things that councils want to do, they can't do because of primary legislation. Mainly, I think, introduced by, funnily enough, by Tony Blair, as a couple were Gordon Brown, but Blair was the culprit for most of it. So I wanted to, as I say, be clear when we start up what we're, the first thing we're going to do once we get into power, and that would be to get rid of a lot of this stuff. So I'm going to run through the ones I want to get rid of, and you can tell me whether you agree or not.
Yeah, no problem.
Okay, the first one I've got is the Constitutional Reform Act. Now, this is the act which effectively abolished the law lords and replaced it with the Supreme Court. Now, it seems to me that this has gone terribly for us, and the Supreme Court is appointed by a committee, and it's the kind of people that they're putting into it, it's all gone against us. So I presume I would have no resistance from you in abolishing that to begin with.
No. One question I'd ask, and this is something that I was thinking about when we were preparing for this a little bit, is how do we actually do it, I think, is as big a challenge for us as just repealing it, because you've got to unpick this whole mess of stuff around the processes. And I think that is going to be as big a challenge. I think we should do it, definitely, but I think actually unwinding us from all of this, I think, is going to be quite a feat. But yeah, in principle, yeah, absolutely.
Certainly, I mean, all of the stuff which has crept into the bureaucracy and local government has to be unpicked. But presumably, yeah, if you just repeal the act and say that act no longer stands, then you can start again, can't you?
Yeah, I think that would make sense. You would probably have to do the same thing where you've got a lead time to say the act is going to go. And then you'd also have to try and put framework in place to say, well, this is the guidance, because what will happen otherwise is you'll get bombarded by every man and his dog saying, oh, what do we do? What do we do? What do we do? We've done this. Why do we do this? And all of those people that are making vast amounts of money from these processes will be doing everything they can to avoid and delay that. So, yeah, it's about implementation as much as it's about the fact that the strategy for that, I think, is just as needed as the repeal itself.
Okay, well, I mean, my thought was that's why I'm bringing it up now, you know, several years before we're going to be in power, is that we should have a program which we publicize in advance and say, on day one or the first 100 days or whatever time frame you want to put on it, we are going to do this. Yeah. So we're going to repeal the Constitutional Reform Act. Now, you may then say, well, we need to give some thought if there's anything it needs to be replaced with. My view on a lot of this is that the laws which I'm talking about don't have to be replaced at all.
Yeah.
And in fact, I'm quite against statutory law in the first place. I think we should go back to some kind of more common law.
Yeah.
But again, it may be that there are certain bits, and that's what I wanted to discuss as we go through each one. If we get rid of it, do we need anything to replace it? So
yeah.
I mean, the Constitutional Reform Act, presumably if we got rid of it, we might have to think whether we want the law lords back or not.
Mm. What would your view be? Because I think it's probably better. I think the danger is you've got to keep the judicial process separate from politics as much as possible, because otherwise you just end up with where we are today, where you have influence which shouldn't be there. And decisions being made which are political rather than for the interest of society in the right way. So yeah, maybe that's better. I don't know a great deal about this, so I'm tiptoeing a little bit around it, so forgive me for that. But that, you know,
no, not at all. I mean, it's not straightforward. I mean, the problem is, of course, that the UK doesn't have a written constitution.
Yeah.
If we were in America, it would be a lot easier because we've got a primary document that we could go refer back to. Whereas in the unwritten constitution, though, in my view, it worked pretty well for several hundred years. And if you just got rid of the Constitutional Reform Act, you would go back to having the executive policed, if you like, by the common law rather than statute law.
But
okay, let's try and get through a few of them. The Human Rights Act. Now, this was the thing which basically put the European legislation into British law. Now, in my view, that's got to go.
Yeah, absolutely. And this is a good one. And I did look this one up. The UK is part of the European Council, which is separate from the EU. But this is the bit that we would have to understand. Could we extract ourselves from that? Because I know the EU would definitely demand, if you're not going to uphold the Human Rights Act, then you can't be part of this council. So maybe that's not a bad thing.
Well, I don't think it's a bad thing at all. I mean, I do think this is one where we do have to replace it with something.
Yes.
I would have thought what we want to do is to have our own Bill of Rights, a UK Bill of Rights, which guarantees the power of the individual vis-a-vis the state, but in a separate form, and one that we probably, if we're going to do this on day one, we need to start working on now in terms of what it should contain.
Yes, because otherwise as well, the fearmongers and those in opposition will say you're harming the different groups, you're harming this person and this group and this racial group when you take this out. There's no freedom protection for these people. So we're not a party that hates people. I know some people think that, but we're not. We're a party that just want to support people in the right way and support those people who are here in the UK. And so I think you have to have some framework of protection around people. I think the problem as well today is a lot of the legislation originally was written at a time where we didn't have global organizations that had huge power and huge influence and, you know, compete with governments in the same way. And I think that's something we have to understand. As much as we want to release and reduce legislation, we have to protect people from those organizations that are there just for the bottom line, and they will crush, defeat. You know, you only have to look at big businesses and their practices and how they operate, where they'll tend to buy out the competitor and not allow market forces to operate competitively. So yeah, we need to put something in place to protect people, but what it is in the format does not need to be as I would describe as insidious as what we have today. Because necessary.
Yeah, obviously you can't have monopolies develop. You have to have some kind of competition legislation, but I wasn't actually thinking of repealing that one.
Right. Okay.
What about the House of Lords Act? This was the one which got rid of all the hereditary peers. Presumably we don't want them back.
I don't think so. I think there's a no... I think we need the second house because its function is to some degree manage the government. I think the danger we have today is governments have reduced again and again the influence of MPs, and so the debates that you see, the idea of challenge to refine law to get it right isn't as effective, and we've seen it over the last 20 years. It's been reduced and reduced. And the House of Lords was, to some degree, that safeguard. And they have done a lot of good work in some places. However, the people in it, I think, is very questionable. You know, if you're great-great-great-great-grandfather, you know, paid the king and killed people.
That makes no sense at all, does it? Yes. No sense at all.
Yeah.
So I wasn't planning to have the third Earl of so-and-so back into the House of Lords. I think that would be retrograde. But it does mean that I agree with you that we do need a reforming second chamber.
Yeah.
But quite what that, how that's composed and so on, I think that needs work. And I think it needs quite a lot of work. But I don't see any reason why we can't do the work in advance of getting power. So we should be able to say our plan is that if you vote us into power, that we'll have our reforming second chamber, which is made up of, and then have the discussion, have our policy, and have it ready to go.
And I think you have to do that now, because if we don't, we're just repeating the errors that we see today. Oh, let's just take, you know, heating costs away from people. And this is a really good idea, because it's done in a vacuum and you haven't spoken to people, and there's not, your granny doesn't get affected by it, but other people's do. And so I think Reform as a party needs to realise we're not that far away. 4 years is not long to get this stuff done, because you have to prepare it. You have to understand exactly what you're going to do, how you're going to do it. And what you're saying, Ken, I 100% agree. I work as a project manager. So the common phrase is fail to plan to fail. So if we plan in advance, we can develop the strategies that make sense, and then we can test them, you know, so you don't test it on people at the last minute, which we've seen so many governments do. And it's just like, no, come on, we're the common sense party. Let's be common sense about this. Let's prepare before we get there. Let's understand what it takes. And this is why I said about when you repeal something, what does it actually take to repeal? Because that in itself is quite complicated. But here, yeah, we need to put the frameworks in. We need to think about it. You know, who constituent, what makes up that second house? And that's a really good question. You know, how do you make it in such a way that it's not your pounds?
There are so many options. You can have it elected perhaps in a different way with proportional representation. Ooh. One interesting idea that I've heard, and I think actually might work quite well, is something called sortition, where you basically randomly select 100 people from the society, and you maybe do some work making sure that they're kind of, but then they're only in the second chamber for a very limited period, so maybe 1 or 2 years. So they can't get caught up. There's no point in lobbying them for influence or whatever, because they're not going to be there in 2 years' time. But that, you know, having a sort of representative panel, if you like, of the population, I think that's quite an interesting one. But it needs a lot of work. I mean, I'm not going to propose it here.
Yeah, I think so.
Moving on, the what about the devolution ones, the Scotland and Wales Act and the Northern Ireland Act? Would you be in favour of repealing those?
Yes and no. I think it's a divisive act, but the problem is, I think it's like when the US repealed drinking in the 30s, the genie's out the bottle, and I don't think you could successfully remove that act without, you know, civil war, literally, with Scotland. I think you know, you're Scottish, mate. Well, Scottish people.
Scotland, you could argue, has been marginally more successful than Wales has. Yeah. But it's still, I mean, I'm Scottish, as you know, and there's an awful lot of bad feeling up there. Both, it's very, very powerful. You know, it's right down the middle. There's SNP and non-SNP, but the non-SNP are quite virulently non-SNP. Yeah. So, but I agree, it's maybe not one that we should put up to start with, but it's one that's certainly worth thinking about as we go along.
I think each country is slightly different, because Wales never seems to have got off the starting blocks properly. And the problem with Northern Ireland is the problem with Northern Ireland. You know, I've grown up with it. I've seen it. And even when you give them power, they seem to still have to fight, which doesn't seem to make. And I understand they've got reasons for that. But we need to, giving them more might not be the right thing to do. So I don't know. On that one, I'm cautious. I don't
I
think
think
you'll be
from a
able to do
political
it.
point of view, you would have to be cautious. It's not a fight we'd want to pick initially.
No.
So well, let's leave that one out
Yeah.
somewhat. What about the National Minimum Wage Act?
Yeah, you. I know we talked about this as a topic. I've got mixed views on it because I've got kids that worked with the minimum wage, and I'm talking kids that have family, and that protection for them is something which at least they know what it is they're going to get. If you take it away, it goes down to the lowest common denominator of who can work and afford to work at that level. And you also, I think, then generate a subsistent layer which will always rely on the state because they can't be elevated out of any level of financial freedom. And I think many years ago, I was on one of the benefits. I've got five children, and I was on one of the benefits because, and I had a reasonable wage, but it wasn't enough to bring me up to a livable standard. And the problem I had was with the benefit, every time I got a pay rise, my benefit reduced, but I still maintained this level. But all of my costs around me were going up.
Yeah,
So it
it's
became, yeah.
the welfare traps it, incredibly, and I've got that on the list as well, the Tax Credits Act, which, to my mind, was one of the cleverest things Blair did, because what he effectively did was expand the welfare state almost limitlessly, because everybody was entitled to tax credits, so everybody then was de became dependent on the state to some a greater or lesser extent for their income. That was from his point of view, it was brilliant.
But that, and that for me is why I think there's a need for a minimum wage because but looking at it from the other side, it hurts small businesses. And we want to generate more wealth. We want to generate more success. And one of the ways we do that is through small business growth, is through that development of that entrepreneurship that people want to see. Because the other thing it does is that entrepreneurship lifts people out of an expectation of failure. And one of the things I like about reform is it says, come on, we don't have to be bottom feeders. We can actually elevate ourselves as a society, as a people. So for me, I'm kind of struggling with this one. I see both
Well,
sides, and I'm not
let me
sure what
help
to
you out there,
do.
because I think it's a very difficult one. I think, again, it's what you were saying. Once you've done something, it's very difficult to reverse it, and very, very politically unpopular to reverse it. I mean, I take a very principled market-led attitude to this, that the market should decide the minimum wage. And from a freedom point of view, if I've got a job that I want done, and its value to me is X amount, and you want to do the job and you're prepared to do it at Y amount, why should anybody else be involved? Why should the state be able to come along and say, just a minute, you can't do that. You can't give Mark that job because it's below the minimum wage. That's nonsense.
As I say, can I give you one more example of this? And
Sure.
this I think is many, many years ago, I worked for a company locally where I live in Wallasey, and it was a company that managed piecemeal, and at the time you got paid for how much you did, and it was like folding documents and stuff like this. And I worked with these guys, and I was a student at the time, young family, but I'd gone back to university, so trying to make ends meet in the summer. And I worked out how to fold things really, really efficiently, so I was doing double what other people were doing, and they actually had to take me off the line because they're like, and it's genuinely true. The guys with me who worked for this company all the time were getting quite agitated by the fact that I was successful and had worked out a system which was more efficient. So So I agree with you that there's a need to not suppress people's capability, and they should be rewarded for that. But, you know, that they actually literally had to take me off the line, and he gave me something else to do. Because, and he said to me, the boss said to me, Mark, said, I can't have you there because you're too quick. You're doing three times as much as other people. And, you know, and then I was earning because they were paid for by the item at the time.
Yeah,
it wasn't
piecework.
Wage. Piecework. And that's the problem. I think it's the reverse, that when you've got that level, you don't reward success. You know, and people then will work at 60% because they don't need to work anymore as well. So, yeah.
I mean, why did he not say, could you go and show your technique to the others and then we could all work at the fast rate?
I think he didn't want to pay people that much. because I did ask him a little bit about this, and he said the problem they've got is they only have a certain amount of work in, and they estimate how long it takes. And if everyone is then done quicker, that people won't come in the next day, and if they get something else, they won't get it. So they were kind of expecting people to work at a certain rate.
But this is why we need flexibility. I mean, remember, I used to work in the fish industry in Aberdeen, you know, 13 hours a day slapping fish on a conveyor belt to get there. Now, when they didn't catch any fish, or sometimes they didn't, then you turned up and there was no fish, no work, and you went away again. It was a brutal way of doing it, but you know, it was economically efficient.
Yeah.
Right, let's move on. The Climate Act.
Yeah. Repeal it tomorrow. It's lunacy. I am fundamentally opposed to, I think, bad science. And you know, I've got chemistry qualifications, and my concern is that a lot of it is bad science, and the environmental problems that we create, you know, it needs to be knocked on the head. And we're spending billions on something which I think
the amount of bureaucracy it creates in local government. I printed this off this morning. This is an equality impact assessment toolkit. That's like 15 pages. Now, this has to be filled in whenever the council does anything. Any policy, whatever it is, has got to go through an equality impact assessment. And it's, the amount of cross-referencing and bureaucracy it creates is astonishing. I think it just has to go.
And I think if you did, it's all those hidden things as well, you would reduce the volume of work that people do significantly. Mm-hmm. And it's paper filling, shuffling, form filling, which is irrelevant and will make no difference. Someone filling that form is going to make absolutely no difference in 20 years to how much CO2 there is. It's probably going to, the fact that they're filling it in, they'll breathe out more CO2. It's just nuts. So
we get rid of the Climate Act, we get rid of the Equality Act, which is the one I was just referring to there with the quality impact assessment, because again, you have to go through, and on that form you have to go through each of the protected characteristics individually. So this one was actually to do with rolling out more money for nurseries for working people. So they then had to go through, will this have any effect on somebody with a disability? Will it have any effect on somebody with, and go through each of the protected characters, somebody who's black, somebody, you know, what are the impacts? And each one has got to be gone through individually and assessed. It's crazy.
Yeah. I didn't realize it was the Equalities Act there. Yeah. Okay. That's nuts as well.
Yeah. But the Climate Act's the same. Again, you've got to do a climate impact assessment on everything you do.
Yeah.
So that early years intervention, they'll have to do a climate impact assessment. You know, what's it mean? It means nothing.
And the problem with it is what do they get from these metrics? Other than an arguing point that people will use politically, it doesn't actually demonstrate anything of any significant value. And yeah, okay, to some degree, some people think they're protected, but really, really, come on. You only have to stand up and say, oh, I'm this, that, or the other, and everyone will, there's an army of people behind you, will go, right, okay, we're going to fight the cause. And we don't need it. Get rid of it.
Yeah. The Crime and Disorder Act, this was the one which brought in ASBOs for the first time. Do you think that's necessary?
The problem for me is I don't think they work. And so I remember what's his name saying, and I can't remember which, I think it was the Prime Minister MP saying, you know, we'll give them £100 fine if they spit in the pavement. And it's like, great, but you'll never get the money back. You'll never implement it because the person will rip it up and throw it away. And then you've got to arrest them to find out who they are, or they give you a false name and address. So for me, that sort of thing.
Well, I remember in Wirral, I don't know whether they're still going, they may well be, they had a unit which was, and I think it was two or three people, whose job was to go around and find people whose dogs pooed on the pavement. Seriously. Yeah. And they did the analysis of how much they'd brought in fines, which was almost nothing, and how much they were costing. It's just astonishing.
So I think there needs to be accountability for behaviour in society. You know, if you're a thug, then you need to be accountable for that. How and what we do, it's the thing for me is that they're, as you said, they're ill-conceived laws. And what and you see it in the tax system. Every economist or help desk person that we have that's working as the tax person today, they make tweaks to the tax system. They don't actually make a change which makes sense. And we kind of need to do the same here. We need to step back and say, look, what do we need as a society in terms of laws that prohibit or stop people or put people in jail? And put them in jail or make them pay a fine and make them pay it. If you rob somebody in your family, you should be forced to take money from your benefits, if you're on benefits, directly from you to pay the person back. There shouldn't be an if, but, well, if we're going to behave as an adult society, then we shouldn't be worried. If people are functioning in our society as adults, we should treat them like adults and hold them to account like adults. And one of my problems today is I see, as we said with this Equalities Act, everybody's got, you know, one leg shorter than the other, or whatever complaint it is that seems to justify their behaviour. But it's like, you still want to be an adult, you still want to do all those other things, so why can't you be held to account when you misbehave?
The point is that, I mean, the Crime and Disorder Act, it was like an additional bit of legislation, wasn't it? I mean, and this is the problem I have with a lot of statute law, is that it adds nothing of value. All it does is creates another statute. So, for example, you know, you have, usually the faster it's implemented, the worse. So you get something like the Dangerous Dogs Act, which says, you know, dogs aren't supposed to bite people anymore, and, you know, but it never works because they can never identify what the real problem is. And the real problem, of course, is people who don't take responsibility for a dangerous dog.
Exactly.
So it's adding on another law, saying, I mean, there was the one recently that you're not, there's a special law for if you assault shop workers.
Completely
unnecessary.
Why are they any different than anyone else?
you've got an excellent law which prohibits people hitting each other. That's all you need. So there's a lot of that stuff which, as I say, can go. I think that's the employment. The problem is a lot of the stuff that Blair did has been overtaken by events. So the Employment Relations Act, he started off. But of course, we've got Angela Rayner is going to bring in one in a few weeks' time, which is going to make that look small beer.
And then encouraging small businesses to develop with an even more complexity of legislation. I thought the whole point of leaving the EU, someone's trying to put us back, but anyway, that's another story. But leaving the EU was to reduce legislation to enable better growth and better development of business. And we seem to be just making it harder and harder for people, not not encouraging them to be entrepreneurial. So, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, the Tax Credits Act is an interesting one because, as I say, what Blair did with it was effectively infantilize the whole population by making us all dependent on the state. Now, the problem is you can't just roll back it from that in one go because it would be too much of a shock to people. So we have to, I think we have to think about what we do. And I think the debate on welfare is a huge one and one that we need to have in reform. And we need to come up with good policies in terms of what we're going to do with it.
I think as you say, we shouldn't be reactionary here, because the problem as well is with legislation, very often governments legislate for the 4 years they're in power. And we need to think beyond that and actually think long term, and think about what makes sense for our society and not just for us getting into power. Because actually, you know, one of the mistakes I think a lot of MPs and a lot of political parties make is they assume a lot of the public is stupid. And I think reform is the exception, because actually they assume most people are intelligent and can think for themselves. And that's one of the reasons it attracts people, because we're not dumbing people down saying, oh, you're a left extremist or you're a right extremist. We're saying, look, we need common sense approach, common sense thinking. And that requires, and that attracts people, whichever left, right leaning position you are, because you go, well, actually, that makes sense. And I think we need more and more of that as a party. And as you say, prepare, think, work through. What does it mean to do this?
And perhaps think a little bit out of the box as well.
Yeah.
And if you see, as we've just done, that it wouldn't be possible to repeal the welfare state in one go. So you can't say on day two, nobody gets any universal credit.
Yeah.
And we'll see how you get on. That's not possible. If you accept that that's not possible, that having ruled out this welfare state, that it can't be brought back in very quickly, what is there something that we could replace it with? Now, my thinking on this is that we'd be far better to repeal the UNIVET, to get rid of universal credit altogether, but to replace it with something like a citizen's basic income.
Mm, yeah.
Now, that's my idea. A lot of people would be against it, but what I'm talking about is a basic income for every citizen, almost like we had during the COVID time, whereby people were being given money for nothing. But have a basic income at a relatively low level, so you have it at I don't know, 10,000-15,000, whatever it is. You set it. You give that to everybody. Now that's your right as a British citizen to have this. It's your basic income. But that's it. That's all you get.
But
now, out of that, you've got to do everything. You've got to feed and clothe yourself, et cetera, et cetera. But you can work on top of that. So you can take a job and that's all on top of your basic income. And at the, you know, if once you get to a certain level, you can start to take the basic income back from you because you're now earning enough that you don't really need it. So that's all possible.
But I would go a little bit further. I would require people to have some level of commitment back in society. So they would have to do something for it, because I think if we want to give people a basic supporting level of income, then I think every person in our society is obliged to do something. So if you're not working, and I know this is, people don't like it, but for me, I think if you're not working, surely you can help out at a charity, surely you can help out at this, surely you can do something. You don't have to do it every day of the week. And I know there is always going to be exceptions before we say, well, granny's only got this, or, you know, this mum with 17 children can't go. Yeah, that those things are real, and I'm not being naive to that. But there's, surely if we give people the basic level, then that they should be responsible and accountable to society to actually contribute. And that means, you know, it does mean maybe we don't pay for street cleaning anymore. We have people that are allocated to do that as part of their, you know, as you say, we can be quite revolutionary and we can think quite out of the box. We've got a few years to prepare for government, but surely we should be experimenting with different approaches rather than just doing the same old thing. Because painting the pig a different colour still makes it a pig, you know, the lipstick on the pig scenario. And I think this is the problem. We need to do something that's different. And it's not about being radical, but it's about being long-term pragmatists about what our society needs, so that we don't get to 20 years time and we're no better off as a society. I think if you do that, you know, you look at the Scandinavian countries, there's a massive amount of trust in those countries, and it's one of those things that builds a society, because people trust people and they integrate and they do those things. I know that they've got problems, but in essence, there are things we can do as a government which are far more long term that will have a better effect and a cohesive effect on our society by thinking about it before we get there, rather than reactionary vote winning.
You know, in order to qualify for citizenship, it needn't be something that needs to be ongoing through your life. Yeah. For example, in Switzerland, what they do in Switzerland, when you get to, I think it's 18, everybody does 1 year in the army.
Yeah.
And that's effectively their contribution to being a Swiss citizen, is they've done a year in the army. And then once they've been in the army for a year and they've given everybody, they give them their gun to take home with them.
Yeah.
So there's not much burglary in Switzerland. Everybody knows, everybody's got a gun and everybody's trained to use it. Now, I'm not suggesting we go down that route, but what I'm saying is that perhaps at the age of 18, it might be that everybody has to do some kind of compulsory service. Now, it needn't be military, but it could be, as you say, you know, working, painting something or whatever it is. It doesn't matter. Yeah. But that's your contribution that you're making to society, and that will give you then the right to citizenship and to UBI and all the other things that come from it.
Yeah, and I think... there should be, I like that. I think there should be some, because you could run it locally rather than nationally. So your local councils have that responsibility. They're supposed to have the responsibility for these people anyway. So why not enable it to be something that's worthwhile? Why not be contributing in your local community?
I think that psychologically it changes everything, because when you get something that you're being given and it's defined and it's an entitlement, it's something that you're entitled to, which you've earned in a way, that's quite different from being given a handout, so it's something, you know, that other people have contributed to give you. That psychologically it's a different sort of thing.
I think the very nature of getting up and doing a job, whatever it is, on a regular basis, is healthy for everybody. You know, it's rather than not working in some format or not contributing in some format, it's psychologically helpful. You only have to look at the evidence of COVID and the number of kids that are messed up. I've got a number of my children who are teachers, and the problems they're still having from COVID, because these kids didn't have structure, because they didn't have things to do. And I think we've seen it in all realms of society, so surely we should learn from that actually structuring people, if they've got nothing to do, with some activity that contributes back, has got to be a better thing than not doing anything. There we go.
It might solve a lot of the youth mental health problems, I think.
It might certainly help towards it, yeah, if it doesn't solve them, yeah.
Yeah. Good. Well, that's been great. Now, of course, what we've been talking about here is what we would do at national government. I don't know how much the policy unit of head office and so on are working on this kind of stuff at the moment. So we'll maybe send them the tape to give them a few ideas. But they certainly should be working on it, because we do need to have all this planned. We've got time, so we need to plan it out properly before we take power. But that's at a national level. At a more local level, we've got a bit of the same problem in Wirral, because it's going to be 2 years before we can possibly get power there and to affect things in terms of Wirral Borough Council. Now, in the other councils which we've already taken over, Zia Yusuf and so on has got his Doge unit working to have a look at all of the wastage and what can be changed in order to make things run more efficiently. Now, we in the Brancheon world have started our own unit, haven't we?
Yes.
And I think you're pretty much it. There's a few, but there's not
there's
too many.
There's a couple of us, yeah. There is.
Do you want to talk about what you're doing and what your plan is?
Yeah, so there's a few things that we want to try and do. One is, and we'd love Zia to come and tell us how they're structuring the Doge today, because this is something new for them. So tell us what you're doing today so we can learn from it for the 2 years that... when we get there in 2 years into power locally. But for us right now, we're doing a few things. We're looking at what the council are doing financially, and we're starting to analyse what does that look like. Because the finances of your public councils, your local councils, are published. You might not have all the details, but you should have enough. And I think every reform council group, every reform group that's going to intend to get into council should start to look at that today and start to look at what there is. You can do that. You can go onto the website. You'll find it. You've got to trawl around, but it's there. It's published. So you can start to look and analyse what are they doing. There's lots of tools, AI tools and stuff, and there's enough people, I'm sure, who can give you direction to do this. But we're analysing what they're spending their money on, how they're spending it, what do the contracts look like, how long are they for, or just the basic principles that we can see. You start from there, then you can start to ask questions, freedom of information questions. Why is this contract 25 years? What are you actually doing for that contract? What have you spent money on, and how is that money, how is that a return on investment? Have you done something that improves things? The other thing we're doing is we're looking at how they're spending money on other activities. So, for example, schools and stuff. What are they doing efficiently and inefficiently in that? Because you can look at them now. I've got family members who are teachers. So I talk to them about what is your end experience of that and how does that work for you in a school, and then look at what the council are doing and then say, well, how are these two misaligned, or how are they aligned? I've got one of my grandchildren is in the special needs program and has a certain particular needs, and that's fine, but I understand the frustration and the hurt of the parents of that child trying to get this all sorted out. So for me, I'm thinking, well, surely I know the council have an obligation, but what are they doing? So that allows me to then start to say, what is going on there? I'm going into detail, but I'll abstract up now. My point is, every single reform group in the country who may not be in council today can start to do things, to think about it, to ask questions. The other thing they can do is go along to their local council meetings. Mm. Understand, if you're going to be a councillor, why don't you go along? Understand, have a look at how your councils run. Have a look at who's in the council and what are they doing? Because you can then start to ask questions about, what is the structure of this committee? How come this person's on that committee? How come they're earning more money because they're on that committee, but they never attend? So... Mm. And that, again, you can start to build out some tactics as a group of what you would do differently to improve. I think, really simply, that's it, without going into nth detail. It's about common sense approach. What financially, what are people doing? Should they be spending that money? What are they spending it on? Is it the right spend? Is there suppliers who are being paid at very small quantities, 100, 200, 300 times. And you got to say, well, is that because they're actually doing a bigger job, but it's been paid for at small amounts in a questionable way? You can look at the contracts as well. Are the contracts really fit for purpose? Who's accountable for the contract? Every single contract in your council should have somebody accountable for it, and is it being reviewed? So if you've got a five-year contract, every year there should be a review. Is it, you know, how much is it costing? Are you getting the results from what you're paying for? Because if no one's checking that, you know, if you pay someone to cut a tree down, does someone check the trees cut down? You know, it's really simple.
Or if you pay somebody to take somebody in a special educational needs kid in a taxi to Blackpool.
Yes.
Has the journey actually been made? Because, yes. I mean, this is the sort of thing they're uncovering in other places, that there are contracts that have been put in place which are still being paid out on.
Yeah.
And people are dead, or the thing isn't happening anymore.
Yeah, or they're being charged £150 for every 10 miles of the journey. And that, you know, we've got evidence of that in certain, not, I haven't seen that on the Wirral, but I know of other councils where that has been done. So there are things you can do now to ask those questions. And as citizens, you're paying your council tax for these people to run this. So surely you should be interested to see what they're doing. And surely it's not a bad thing to start to look and ask questions. So, yeah, for me, there's common sense things we can do now. We can prepare. We've got some people that are really skilled locally in the Doge team. And so they use a lot of tech to do things. And I'm sure there are people in most reform groups that can do that. The last thing I would say is one of the things I'm trying to do, and maybe I can share this, is write a guide for this, quite simply, because I know one of the councillors in Chester asked me if I would write one at the last reform meeting. Our local branch meeting, she came, Mandy, and said, "Mark, would you write us something?" So I'm writing something right now. So maybe we can share that with other groups to get excellent. Something better. There you go.
No, you must make the work that you're doing work as far as we can. That makes absolute sense. What are we going to do as we do find things out as we go along before we get power? You know, for in the next 2 years, we need to also plan how we use that. So, I mean, we need to be going along. If we find something abhorrent in Wirral Borough Council, we need either to be taking it up directly with the people involved, or at the very least, be going along to council meetings and asking questions about it, don't we?
Yes. And let's just be clear. We're not at war with people. We're not trying to catch people out. What we're trying to do is make a better society, and where we see waste and inefficiency, surely it's a good thing, because we know governments are notorious, big, small governments, local governments, they're all the same.
They're spending other people's money, Mark. That's the problem.
And they're not necessarily being accountable for it in the right way. And I think the more people we start to look at this, not so much to hurl bricks, but to say, can we do something better? Because if you spend £10 million, or you waste £10 million on buying a market building that's no longer needed, then that money could have been used for something really useful in a school or several schools. And so for me, it's kind of like, what we want to do is we're not attacking our local councils. We're trying to make it better. And I think that's important for people to understand. This, you know, we're not there with the pitchforks trying to have a fight. We're trying to actually, look, we've got to do things better.
Yeah, I agree entirely. Look, Mark, that's been fantastic. Thanks very much indeed.
Oh, thanks. Bye, Ken.
Cheers now. Bye.